November 4th, 1983, Long Beach, California. Jan Law, interviewed by Cabe Regal, in his office.
I'm not at all sure that this should be recorded for posterity, but you will find in the back portion of the Stanford research where I'm attempting to describe the very soft nature of the Wilmington overburden, which provided no internal strength of self-support. It sat like a wet, uncooked pancake, a dead weight, completely willing to fold and meet consolidation below. No self-support. What was it? Well, one cores of the overburden within the sandy portion resulted in cores that would pour out of the core barrel like beet sand. They were just completely unconsolidated, very recent deposits, because there had been 1,800 feet of recent subsidence. The clay shales were also punky and had no body, no resistance. At one point, they had a dough quality. At one point in the course of drilling, the roughnecks recognized a wheelbarrow shale. And the wheelbarrow shale was caused by the fact that when the drill stem, and particularly the drill collar at the bit and so on, came out with a heavy sheath of mud clay adhered tenaciously, and they would take axes and hatchets and skim off this 2-3 inch sheath of clay again representing no strength, moldable clay wheelbarrow, because it took a wheelbarrow loads to carry away the gleanings off of the drill pipe when you came out of the hole. That was an important part to me to describe the soft texture of the overburden. Well, there was, just below that was the elephant turd shale, which made, as the words say in the Stanford research, oblate masses of so many 2-3 inches in elliptical diameter, and that they floated around and caused problems, and the roughnecks needed to take off the master bushing and get rid of the elephant turd shale because it would plug the pipes. Again, descriptive of the weak overburden, as any good scientist would do. And I guess the use of the elephant excreta as the thing was identifying. There's been other anatomy and other things used in nature, but people read that and said, well, ha, 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 how come you write that up in Stanford research, thing like that. And I said, well, they didn't have to publish it, did they? But they did. If you will put your box over there, we're now going to attempt to, this seems to be a quite a bit of material, certainly subsidence, but not directly Wilmington. I'm looking for, and I'll find for the first one to put in the box, Bechtel retained me to write for the Atomic Energy Commission the vulnerability to the offshore desalting plant, which was immediately offshore of what was then Tin Can Beach and now Bolsa Beach, the Bolsa Gun Club, and the location fell within the outer perimeter of the small bowl of subsidence, which is true and exists, properly positioned over the offshore Huntington Beach oil field. And so this, called Appendix J, an estimate of future horizontal movement, vertical movement, surface strain, Jan Law Consultant, this is Appendix J to a very thick, my goodness, 4 inches or so, volume put together, assembled by Bechtel, presented to the Atomic Energy Commission, in turn presented to, in hearings open to politicians and do-gooder societies, interested citizens, and it was instrumental, contributory to the acceptance by state, county, maybe federal, Atomic Energy Commission, Bechtel, contributory to accepting that as an acceptable drill site, an acceptable drill site, an acceptable island for desalting.
Excuse me, I'm out of just 1 minute, please.
You sure may. And it isn't the most profound, but it says that in the year of question, that here was what they, that I think the best thing that showed on their statements that the desalting offshore island drill site, atomic energy desalting of ocean water, co-generation of electricity and generation of fresh water, that at that time, the using the analogy and the anatomy of Wilmington for magnitude, amount of destruction, horizontal motion, vertical motion, all to be applicable here is part of the, certainly the history, and that is not trivial in the geologic industrial development of the knowledge of subsidence. These are an interesting set of books. Ulysses S. Grant. I hate to be derogatory. So, but I'll say my say. He was interested, fascinated with subsidence. He was a professor of anthropology and was maybe a minor or something in micropaleontology. He was the geologic student of the life sciences as they made fossils and produced geology. He became certainly entranced with subsidence. It must have stimulated. He was a blood descendant, a lineal blood descendant of President Grant. And he wrote various reports, and he was retained by the Board of Harbor Commissioners for a good number of years to advise him. Here is a 1956 publication review of recent reports on subsidence. He reviewed other people's, including mine. Here is one in 1956, a review of the report on subsidence by Jan Law, in which he reviewed the big opus, namely the collar count, which is called officially Interrelationships of Earth Movements in the Long Beach Harbor Area, and his reviews were quite superficial, I just must say. But he was active. There is some really good stuff in there. Some absurdities. This was a very important document called Findings of Facts and Orders by the State of Oil and the State Oil and Gas Supervisor, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, State of California, relative to repressioning operations in certain pools and faults of Fault Block 23456 in the Wilmington Field. And this was the basis upon which the state law, well, rules or law, I don't know how to distinguish, which says if there's a threat of inundation, if first there's a production of oil, and the production of oil is related to the consolidation and subsidence, and thirdly, if there's a threat of inundation, then there shall be mandatory unitization. And mandatory unitization was necessary because the leaseholder, the operator, the lessee, he has an established position. He has a salary derived or a portion derived or a profit derived from the production of this lease. When it's unitized, he is completely kicked off, disposed of. He's disposable. His lease with six wells is put in with 150 other wells, run by one outfit, and he gets, for his leasehold interest, a 10%, 1% of fraction of the total net proceeds. But he is the same as some other. He's the same as a kulak in Russia, where unitization, collectivization, threw out the kulak and made a great big state farm. The parallel was there. So it was necessary in this country, parallel is there. So it was necessary to have mandatory unitization because that was their lifestyle, their bread and butter. And when they were displaced off of their position of being the sole producer, guardian, shepherd of his six flock, his six oil wells, he became a disenfranchised person. Mandatory unitization followed the findings of facts and orders upon which this group of people were displaced. Important. Long Beach Harbor Department, Petroleum Division, summary of downhole casing joint measurements since 1950. Well, my report, Interrelations, give all the collar count of all, I think, 26 wells and repeat on half of them up through 1950, and this is 1957, and gives a report. And it follows the schematic diagrams that I used and the tabulated schedules that I used and showed here that whereas these joints had experienced 200s, 300s, here's 5/10 of a foot, and here's 1 foot. As these joints had experienced not a half a foot by 1949, having been put in the hole, because this is a half a foot, and that's quarter of a foot. Here, this same thing not only passed this, but one passed a total foot of shortening, and these had all shortened more than half a foot, and the system here is consistent. This little evidence of tension, compression, can be the uncertainty between the original measurement of the joint of pipe, which was done by a tape. One man at one end of the tape, one man at the other of the tape, and he read out the joint lengths, and the third scribe, that's the engineer, wrote down the joint lengths as they were reeled off as the joint was measured first on the ground and then screwed together up in the air. Well, they call it the dumb end of the tape, which you don't read, you just hold. The dumb end of the tape was often misheld because they used the dumbest man on the place and he held it a little too short or a little too long. And the tapes weren't always perfect. So there was this, but that is not a tenth of a foot, it's a half of a tenth of a foot in here, which is a measure of uncertainty. Why that should happen, but it disappeared. It's a freak. Oh, I know, there was sometimes the collar count device, which was electromagnetic, evidently got a false reading, a false magnetism for some unknown reason. But that is the type of evidence that was that has been accepted as being unqualified. The length of the pipe in the overburden was essentially the same, and there's many of them that go through, and the length of the pipe was the original tally below the tower ranger and upper terminal. Well, there's another expression. This wiggle from plus and minus, which isn't constant, between 49, 50, 54, and 57, and this is here is the uncertainty. Between rungs, none of the measuring systems were precise, but this uncertainty is called the noise level, and this is called the message level. And here the message level is as much as a foot and three quarters and lots of halves against a noise level of one-tenth, two-tenths, and so on. Plus, you have the consistency in here. That this, for instance, it probably is not true, and this is probably a truer expression, but we don't know. So there's uncertainty within here, the same as there's uncertainty in a noise level within there. But again, that is taken by the engineering world as being I'll have to read what happened. 49, 550, 450. There's a story of some kind. I don't know what it is. There's an example of quite a small noise level, but again, the throw wasn't so great either. People looked at enough of these things and they said, sure, we have this, but this overpowers the noise. The message comes through overpowering over the noise.
Yeah, I have a question. Was oil produced from the Ford zone?
Oh, yeah.
But it didn't consolidate?
No.
Okay.
Geologists use the term friable. Friable means crumble with your fingers. We also use the term sucroidal, meaning the sands are the same consistency and act like sugar. Sucroid, sugar. The overburden were sucroidal. You could pour them. You could dig them with a shovel. The tall ranger and upper terminal, which were the unstable zones, which gave birth to the consolidation, were all friable. A little bit less friable as you got to the bottom of the upper terminal. Some people said that the lower terminal consolidated. I don't believe. But the lower terminal, forward, UP-237, all of these down here, you could only break a sand core with a hammer. You couldn't break a chip a quarter of an inch thick. A chip that would be 2.5 inches in diameter, quarter of an inch. Maybe you could break it, but it would be difficult. That followed just on a kind of plain common sense. That if you could make grindstones, whetstones, knife sharpening stones, round things, peddling, you could make that and building stones out of these oil sands, they were not easily. You would say that they would resist consolidation, that they were already sufficiently, the sand grain was sufficiently compacted, and they had been there under a greater overburden, because this was a light and young overburden to this, but all of this was an overburden to that, and age makes a difference. So it isn't surprising one bit that below the Tower Ranger and upper terminal, this, by the way, top of the lower terminal, and they say the upper portion of the top of the lower terminal did show some, but this is UP, Union Pacific and forward are said to be inert. And it's not mysterious, these now there, I think we talk about this, that the people who ran the pipe in the hole, just the dumb end or the smart end of the tape was just off. That this is unique enough that it didn't elongate. If it stretched that much, it would pull in two. So that is dated December 4th, 1957, summary of downhole casing joint measurements since June 1950, I think is a very adequate follow-up of the interrelations and the first. And Brock, Leonard Brock, who later became manager of the oil properties, was a pretty competent person, and he talks about, under the direction Jan Law, that the earlier work was carried on. That is a darn good follow-up. This is an earlier that I've already given you, notes on the mechanic of compaction. Would you like to avoid a question? Would you like to avoid duplicates?
Well, we don't really have any use for them.
Well, are you saying yes or no?
Yes.
Just tell me.
Yes.
You'd like to avoid duplicates?
Yes.
All right.
Because what's valuable and important about your collection is that it's one copy of something that isn't anyplace else, right?
Don't ask me to say right,
okay.
Because if I'd really knew what, I wouldn't ask the question.
Okay.
And with a sincere question. This is a study. What is this? An estimate of future subsidence, Bolsa property, Huntington Beach, California, prepared for Signal Properties. The 2,000 acres of the Bolsa Gun Club, which it originally included all of Tin Can Beach, which was taken from them in condemnation, but give you an idea, about 3 miles along the ocean. 2,000 acres, was bought by Signal Properties from the owners for a biggest portion of the $24 million, and they wanted to know what was their prospects of future subsidence, because they, the bowl of subsidence, whose center was located properly over the offshore, but the bowl extended on to the Bolsa properties, what was their future look like? We used the same reasoning and analogy that we did for Bechtel and the Atomic Energy Commission to give a report on the future of the 2,000 acres of the Signal properties, the old gun club, and I think for sure 1971, that what I said in 1971 has proved to be correct. My approximation is what they've had. But I haven't looked. No, I haven't. So I can't prove it, but that's what it is. Here is summary of operations, but devoted to Wilmington oil field subsidence and repressuring. Evidently, as part of that thing, finding of facts and future, the state of California called upon the Division of Oil and Gas. And there is the, well, a considerable thick volume. Routine elevation changes. This is a very interesting. A study of harbor and Seal Beach steam plants in vicinity, September 1941, October 51, by the Design and Construction Division, Department of Water and Power, City of Los Angeles. The Department of Water and Power, had the steam generating plant located on the Wilmington oil field, subject to subsidence. And they built the water and power, which is here on Sarita's Channel. And, they had the Seal Beach steam plant, the old plant that was right on the edge of the ocean. The smokestack was knocked off in the earthquake of 1933. And these people make a very down-to-earth, they were not they, the authors, A.L. Williams and J.D. Laughlin, were not, as many people were in Wilmington, Long Beach subsidence, captured by the glamour of destruction, the emotional response, the great cataclysmic, which disturbed people, I say, was part of the complete fascination of Ulysses Grant, that here was a dramatic, cataclysmic, big doomsday potential. Therefore, he left his firm footing. These people were really down to earth and did an excellent job, and they show a study performed by bureaucrats, Los Angeles Water and Power, sincere technicians, no glamour. Down to earth and good publication. Elevation changes, routine. I think that the Baldwin Hills Reservoir disaster, I think it was around $12-13 million, was the judgment paid by Standard Oil and other operators in Englewood to defray the cost of the number of homes that were swept away from the Baldwin Hills. And